Hello and welcome to Fast Talk, your source for the science of endurance performance. I'm your host, Trevor Connor, here with Coach Rob Pickles. Many pros do it. In fact, they do it a lot. If they're going up a hill or sitting on a trainer, they're spending tons of time at either higher than normal or lower than normal cadence. Pros who do swear by it claim that cadence work is critical to their success. In fact, it's so ingrained in cycling culture that junior cyclists are required to use special gearing to ensure they learn how to ride at higher cadence from the start of their careers. There's just one problem. There's not a lot of evidence that cadence work does what we believe it does for us. In fact, our common belief that longer efforts like 20 minutes at 50 RPM is, quote, strength training on the bike, has been conclusively disproved. Our guest today, Dr. Ernst Hansen, has studied cadence work for over a decade. 2017, he wrote a review of the existing research on low cadence training with Dr. Bent Rønnestad and was left underwhelmed. Dr. Hansen is himself an ex-professional cyclist who now works at the University College Absalon in Denmark. We talk with him about the beliefs and reality of both high and low cadence training. Why we all naturally choose to ride above our most efficient cadence. Why low cadence sprints are actually promising. If there's a neuromuscular effect, and ultimately, what does he recommend? His research has shown some surprising results that can improve the performance of even the best cyclists. Yet our longstanding beliefs about cadence are so ingrained it's proved next to impossible to change mindsets. Joining Dr. Hansen, we'll hear from professional cyclist Alex Howes, ex-World Tour rider turned commentator Brent Bookwalter, legendary physiologist Dr. Bent Rønnestad, and elite coaches Hsiang Amiri and Neil Henderson. So find your comfortable cadence, then pedal slower because that's actually what's optimal. And let's make you fast. Tis the season for spring knee. As sunshine and spring weather inspires us to ramp up our riding mileage, our knees don't always keep up. If you got knee pain, we have the solution for you. Fast Talk Lab members can follow our knee health pathway, featuring Dr. Andy Pruitt. See the introduction in the knee health pathway at fasttalklabs.com. Well, Dr. Hansen, thanks for joining us. We're really excited to have you on the episode today.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this episode.
So I'm going to say the same thing. I, as a coach, have always been fascinated with cadence work. And certainly reading the research and talking with a lot of pros, you see pros do a ton of both high and low cadence work. But what I find really fascinating is when I've read the research on this, including a study that you did with Dr. Rønnestad, the evidence is, say, murky, not great, that doing either high or low cadence work is actually effective. So I've been really excited to do this episode, and you're the perfect expert on this because this is what you research and you're an ex-professional cyclist. You know, why is it that pros are doing so much of this type of work if we're not necessarily seeing a ton of evidence for it? And that's really what the episode is going to be about today. But before we dive into it, I think we need to just do a couple definitions that I'll throw to you. What do we mean by the three terms of freely chosen cadence and then high cadence and low cadence?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I can give my point of view on that, but there's not a consensus regarding that question. So it depends on who you ask, I guess. But the freely chosen cadence is relatively straightforward. Right. So I think most people consider it the automatically generated cadence that you produce, that you apply when you don't think specifically about what you're doing. Right. So it's a kind of an unconsciously controlled cadence. And this is very different from rider to rider. And this is very important to remember that at the same absolute or relative power output, it can be from 60, for example, to 100. So there's a huge between individual variation in the freely chosen cadence, even among professional or very highly trained cyclists. We have seen that over and over again. And then, of course, you have lower cadences and you have higher cadences. And how low does it have to be to be considered low? I don't know. You know, if you look at many of the studies that have been done and where they have used the freely chosen cadence and then a higher and a lower, many of these studies, they use plus 30%, for example, for higher cadence and minus 30% for low cadence. But, you know, it's up to anyone to make the definition of how low does it have to be considered low. So there's no consensus on that.
So in that situation, if we take somebody that has, say, a freely chosen cadence of 80 RPM, 80 revolutions per minute, just to choose a number, a high cadence for that person plus 30% would be about 105, 104 RPM, and a low cadence in that situation might be something around 56, just to put some real numbers around that.
Yeah.
As you pointed out in some of the research, they just use an absolute value. They go, well, 60 is low and 105 is high. But that's not necessarily true for all athletes. You get a track cyclist in the study and have them do 105.
Yeah, 105 is low.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point, because when we do these studies, we like to control as much as possible so that we can have the answer of whatever thing we are changing, right? And many of these studies, especially the earlier studies, so some decades ago, they used often set cadences, right? So if they wanted to investigate the effect of cadence on oxygen uptake, for example, they used 40, 60, 80, 100 RPM, right? And they did that systematically for all the participants in the study. And they didn't even bother, or they didn't even think about measuring the freely chosen cadence. But when I came into the research 25 years ago, the focus changed. So it seemed like researchers, they got aware of, hey, there's a huge variation between individuals in this. So we better, you know, at least measure that also and try to design some studies where we take the starting point from the freely chosen cadence and then do some higher and lower cadences to investigate energy turnover, performance, or whatever we are interested in.
Before we move off of this definition sort of segment that we're doing, there's another factor that seems like it influences cadence, and that is workload. And so I'm wondering, you know, based on how the research is defining, is there a means that you can share what like a low, a moderate, and a high workload are for an individual when we're correlating that with cadence?
Well, you have these definitions for workload that you also use regarding training intensity, right? So often you use a percentage of maximum oxygen uptake, VO2 max. Other times you use power output and you focus on that. And you maybe have a peak power in some kind of test, and then you use relative values to that. It doesn't really matter whatever you do. What we see regarding the freely chosen cadence is that it increases with intensity. So it starts, for example, at around 70 RPM for a group of cyclists. It would start around 70 RPM at 50% of VO2 max. And then it increases up to around 80 or 90 RPM when you approach maximum oxygen uptake. So there's an increase in the freely chosen cadence with increased intensity. What is interesting is that you also have an increase in the optimal cadence, the energetically optimal cadence. It also increases with increased intensity. It starts lower. So it's maybe around 50 at 50% of VO2 max. And then it also increases with increased intensity. And what happens is that when you approach the VO2 max, the freely chosen cadence and the energetically optimal cadence, they merge. So they become the same. And this has a consequence. If you consider that, you will find that at low intensities, most people, they move really energetically not optimal. So they spend too much energy pedaling the crank. And this is not the case when you exercise at high intensity. And what are we talking about? Yeah, we are talking about approximately 5% in oxygen uptake or energy turnover. So you spend around 5% too much. You are inefficient at the low intensities because of the cadence that you are applying.
So this gets me to something I did really want to ask you about before we dive into low cadence and high cadence work, which was, you talked about this in a review you wrote in 2009, and we'll put all the references in the show notes. But there is a paradox that we've known about for over 100 years, which is what you're talking about, which is everybody, their freely chosen cadence is actually above the most efficient cadence.
Yeah, at least, you know, at the lower intensities. So again, when you get to the high intensity around VO2 max, then there's no paradox anymore. Then the freely chosen and the energetically optimal cadence, they are the same value.
And Dr. Hansen, is that something that we see across levels of cyclist? Like if we take the untrained average university student who maybe they play pickleball now, you know, pickleball is the new hot thing, and you bring them in for a cycling study, do they also exhibit this paradox, or is it just in the cyclists who are habituated?
No, my experience and my knowledge from the literature is that it doesn't matter what the kind of cycling history you have. And it's across children, adults, doesn't matter. It's simply, you know, a human behavior.
And I loved your theory behind this. I should mention, I'm kind of a part-time evolutionary biologist. And you brought up the evolution of this, which is, you know, you look at people walking and running, and they do naturally pick the most efficient paces and cadences. But we've been evolving for millennia around running and walking. We've been on bikes for 100 years.
Are you saying we're a bunch of idiots, Trevor?
Pretty much. But you bring up this idea of a central pattern generator that we have in our bodies, and it just actually makes us choose a cadence that's not optimal.
It could be the explanation, yeah. So at least, you know, we know that we are not shaped, we are not designed for cycling because we have been cycling for such a short period compared to our evolution, right? So we are designed for something else, and we are probably relatively well designed for walking and running. So if it has been important, and I think it's fair to assume that at long periods of our evolution, it has been important that we could move ourselves, travel across long distances in an efficient way, right? With a little energy turnover. So that is what we do naturally when we walk and run. And maybe the way we cycle is that we use some of these neural networks we have for other purposes. They are developed for walking and running, and maybe we use at least parts of these neural networks to generate the cycling movement, and then it comes out as it comes out. So, yeah, it's not easy, you know, when you cycle at a sub-maximal intensity where you are not really feeling under pressure or exhausted or anything. It's not easy to feel, to perceive a 5% difference in energy turnover or oxygen uptake. So it's something else, you know, that controls what you're doing.
Dr. Hansen wrote several papers with Dr. Ronestad on cadence and efficiency. So let's take a minute to hear from Dr. Ronestad himself and why the nature of the event may force the athlete to consider more than just what cadence is most efficient.
There are at least some potential explanations as to why that could be beneficial. And I mean, it depends a bit on, for instance, if you are a mountain bike rider, for sure there are arguments for that you should use both high and low cadence. And also on the road, we know that there is a quite large difference in the cadence you use during steep uphill versus flat terrain. So in theory, there could be gains from systematically training with both high and low cadence.
Do you feel there's a different metabolic impact when you do training at either a high or a low cadence?
Yeah, at least theoretically, there are indications that you get a slightly different metabolic stimulus and maybe also regard to fiber type involvement. So you can get overall larger total stimuli by switching cadence.
So you say different fiber recruitment. Could you dive a little deeper into that? So are you saying when you do low cadence, you're going to recruit more fibers or...
Yeah, at least I know some studies indicating that with low cadence, you have a larger recruitment of the fast-twitch fibers.
So guys, I want to say, you know, I think you both were able to say why you were excited for this episode. And I was excited for this episode too, for one specific reason. I don't really believe in cadence. I mean, I guess I believe in cadence, right? I know that we pedal a bike. I know we can measure that. But I've never really done any specific cadence work with athletes, with myself, outside of maybe they're in an event that has very specific requirements. There's a kilo and we have to practice a standing start because it's very different to grind from zero. But for general riding, general athletes, I don't know.
So Dr. Hansen, before we dive into this, let's throw this to you. I mean, we know pros do a lot of cadence work. Are they wasting their time? What's your 1 minute take?
It's a complicated thing because what are we talking about? Are we talking about the cadence that you apply when you do steady state submaximal exercise for hours? Is that what we are talking about? Or is it the cadence that you apply if you do some intensive acceleration exercises that are more functional strength training, for example? Is that what we are talking about? So to answer it, I think you need to be a little bit more specific. I can say a very general comment about it, which I think is important. And that is, if you are a road cycling or mountain bike cycling for that sake, an endurance cyclist, you spend many, many hours on your bike. And of course, you do some specific intervals and you do some specific training, but you have many, many hours where you just pedal. And I think that what we sometimes tend to overlook is to have enough variation in the training. So if you just do the same over and over again without introducing some variation in your training, you stall, you reach a steady state performance level. And you need to do something different to stimulate your body. And cadence work is one tool to stimulate your body, including fiber type recruitment, energy turnover, and many, many other things.
Well, Trevor, I think we need to dive into this a little deeper because I can't tell if I'm vindicated or not.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring up a study quickly that might vindicate Rob a little bit, but let's debate this.
Oh, that's why I'm
so
here.
So I'm sure you've read this. This is a 2012 study from a doctor. And I'm going to absolutely butcher this name.
You butcher them all.
Niemerreicher.
Yeah, Niemerreicher.
Final author was Dr. Craig Williams, which I can't pronounce. But what was fascinating about this study was, so they had three groups and they were testing the effects of doing high cadence interval work and low cadence interval work on time trial performance. So they had three groups, one group that did the intervals at high cadence, one group that did the intervals at low cadence, and then a group that did same volume, but no interval work whatsoever.
Random, but okay.
And here was the result of the study. They all saw equivalent improvement. Not just the cadence groups doing intervals, but the group doing no intervals.
What?
Yeah.
Explain this to me.
Now, there was only one thing that they did point out, which was the only group. So they did both an uphill time trial and a flat time trial. And the only group to see improvement in both time trials was the low cadence group. So how do we explain this?
Well, so it was in the intervals, right? They changed the cadence.
Yep.
What type of intervals was it? Was it like 5 minutes?
It was 6x5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's difficult to explain precisely all the results that we see in the literature. So to be able to give some general recommendations regarding training, for example, we often need to see more than one study. So we often need to see, you know, a bunch of studies pointing in the same direction, because we can sometimes get odd results in single studies. So I think you should be careful about that. So that is one that is one thing to say about it. But I'm not sure that it's easy to simply change the cadence in some intervals and then expect to see, you know, a significant change in performance. We are talking about small differences here, right? When we do these studies. So if you are studying athletes who have already trained, it's not easy to make them better, right? So that's also a part of the study. And so if it was that easy, you know, you could make much more money as a coach. But it's difficult. It's difficult to change performance even 2, 3 or 4%. And that is what we need often to see a statistically significant change in these studies. You often need a change of at least 4 to 5%. And we all know that, well, we are actually interested in 1 and 2% improvements also. If we are talking, you know, performance for an athlete, if you could change the performance for an elite athlete by 1 or 2%, you would do a good job, you know. But it's very difficult to make a scientific study where you show a 1 or 2% change in a group of athletes and show it statistically.
Many of you might know him as one of the voices of the Tour de France, but Brent Buchwalter was a World Tour rider himself, and we got his take on whether Kaden's work helped his training.
Yeah, I definitely did high to low cadence work. I probably did more low cadence work than high for, you know, to tap into that strength component. I'd say the really for a lot of pros, that big gear work, especially early in the year, as strength building, as activation work, is really bread and butter, big part of the training focus. So for me, I think it stems back to when I had a severe leg fracture in 2007 when I got my career going. But ever since that, I always defaulted to quite a high cadence. So it was important in those winter months that I spent some time focusing to, you know, stay seated, focus on this pedal stroke, focus on engaging my core properly. And then that built some strength, it built some foundation, and then it also enhanced fatigue resistance to harder training sessions later and the races once they got going.
So would you do interval work with low cadence, or would you just go out for your rides and just keep the cadence low?
No, definitely interval work is actually one of the more enjoyable workouts, I'd say. It's something that, you know, the zones we were doing it in, it wasn't like a big time suffer fest situation. But it's, you know, it's by nature, it's meant to be controlled and it's meant to be focused, and it's demanding, it's difficult, but it's not like unachievable by nature, because if you start falling apart, you've lost the point of it and it's time to stop. So yeah, it was quite enjoyable. I'd go out, you know, when I was training on my own, I would build a route with climbs of good grade, and I would, you know, include that low RPM work on the climbs as demanded by my training program. And throughout my career, I really started to become a little more flexible with it, which I think also benefited me. I think the tendency at our training camps with the team, or, you know, everyone's different, but is that work is often done going up, down, up, down, up, down. And there's benefits to that too, totally taking the load off the muscle going down, just, you know, coasting, spinning it out. But for me, I loved using climbs in a loop, because it would force me to stretch it out a little longer, you know, on some climbs. Or other climbs, I'd realize like, oh, you know, I'm a couple minutes short. Like, I can actually squeeze a little more power, like dip my RPM a little bit. And that was really, you know, that got down to like, you know, my own art of training, which I have definitely a greater appreciation on at the end of my career than I did at the start, looking back.
So let's dive into low cadence training for two reasons. One is, you're right, you can't look at one study, but when you look at multiple studies, that's, I feel, where you've seen a little more evidence of improvement. For example, there was a 2016 study led by Dr. Witte, which showed that low cadence training improved TT power. There was also the Patton study that showed that low cadence sprints were more effective than high cadence sprints. But the main reason I want to go there is in 2017, you wrote a review with Dr. Ronestad on the impacts of low cadence training. And maybe I've got this wrong, but it seemed like your overall assessment from the review was, A, it was hard to draw any conclusions because of the differences in all the different studies. But overall, the evidence was not overwhelming about benefits of low cadence training. So throw that to you, having written that review and read all this research, what you're feeling about low cadence training? Is there a benefit to it?
No, you know, things haven't changed since our paper from 17. I agree. And there's not a lot of research done, you know, before that and after that. So we don't know much more today, I would say. But this doing this review, it inspired ourselves to do a study. So we actually tested a training form that we know is done and common, at least, you know, where in the environments that I'm involved with. And that's accelerating sprints starting from a low speed. So you start in a big gear ratio, which means a low cadence, and then you accelerate from that for a few seconds, and then you take a break, and then you do it over again. So that you could also call low cadence training, but it's very, very intensive. It's actually, you know, maximal intensity, and we saw improvement in power in peak power output in the group that did that kind of training, compared to a control group who just continued their usual training. So we could measure an effect of that kind of training, and the effect was on peak power output. We could only see a tendency for results in more classical test parameters like anaerobic threshold and the power at VO2 max. So that was a little bit disappointing for us. We hoped to see changes there also, but we didn't. But the training had an effect. And what we are speculating about is that, okay, if we, with this kind of training, can improve peak power output, it was 4%. Maybe, you know, that is also relevant if you think about classics like Tour of Flandern, where you have all these climbs where they go very intensively over these climbs over and over again. Or if you have off-road cycling like mountain bike or cyclocross, where you have to do this accelerating over and over again. If you, every time you have to do this, have a 4% improvement, then, you know, it would probably add up to something. So I still believe in this kind of training. But when I was active cyclist years ago, another kind of low cadence training was done. And that was climbing on a mountain for 10, 15, 20 minutes. So steady state, sub-maximal exercise, but done in a large gear ratio with a low cadence. So that is another kind of low cadence training.
Which is one of my favorite forms. I love doing that.
Yes, but it has never been investigated, as far as I know, this kind of or that kind of training. So we simply don't know the effect of that kind of training. And the last thing that is also kind of interesting, perhaps, is that we did a study some years ago where we asked a group of cyclists to do two kinds of prolonged exercise. Actually, we had them cycling for 2.5 hours in the lab. In one day, they had to do this prolonged submaximal exercise at the freely chosen cadence. That was very natural for them. And we measured energy turnover and oxygen uptake and performance in the end of this exercise. That was one day. Another day, they had to do the same, but at a lower cadence, actually at the energetically optimal cadence. And their reaction to our request was that, no, we cannot do that. We cannot exercise at that low cadence. It's not possible. But we convinced them. For some of them, it was like 60 RPM. And for some, I think it was down to maybe 55 or something for some individuals, right? But we convinced them to do the study. And you know what happened? What happened was that we measured the rate of perceived exertion, so the Bohr scale. We asked them every 30 minutes during this prolonged cycling, right? And what happened was that at the low energetically optimal cadence, when they came to 2.5 hours, they reported lower efforts than at their freely chosen cadence. So to begin with, they wouldn't even do it, because they thought we were crazy and we were harmful to them and all other kinds of excuses. But it turned out that they reported lower rate of perceived exertion scores after 2.5 hours. They didn't know themselves because they couldn't remember what they reported last time they were in the lab. But it came clearly out in the data. And the explanation is, of course, that they saved a lot of energy. They saved 5% all the time, and it accumulated up to a lot after 2.5 hours of exercise, which caused them to feel it easier to bike, even that they have to use the low cadence. So that is just indicating that something funny is going on here, that we have a very strong tradition. We have a very strong tradition and history in cycling that things should be done in a certain way. But when we throw in something new like this, there might be a window for performance improvement also. We saw a tendency. We did a 5 minutes all-out performance test at the end of this prolonged cycling. We saw a tendency for a better performance following the low energetically optimal cadence. That was a shame. We thought that was a shame because it was only a tendency. We didn't have enough subjects. This is my analysis of it today. We didn't have enough subjects. Had we had more subjects, it would have turned out statistically significant. Some years later, another group, Steppins and co-workers from University of California, they did a study that was very similar to ours. They kind of replicated our study, and they found the difference that we couldn't see. Mm. So you have two studies there pointing at the same way that this is not about training. So this is about the cadence that you apply if you have to perform, right? So there are some interesting results there. But my point was that, you know, maybe one effect of training with a low cadence, maybe an effect is that you adapt to it and you find that it's okay to use that in competition. And then that could be a way to better performance. But this is not what we normally measure in the studies. We measure performance. So we measure power output in some kind of test, or we measure efficiency or something. But maybe we should look for some other aspect of performance.
Interesting.
Pathways from Fast Talk Laboratories are a new way to explore concepts, master skills, and solve training challenges. Our new cycling interval training pathway begins with the basics of interval workouts and progresses to more advanced details: how to flawlessly execute interval workouts, which intervals bring which adaptations, and how to analyze your interval workout performance. Over 21 articles, interviews, workshops, and workouts, our new cycling interval training pathway offers you the chance to master cycling's most critical and nuanced workout format. See this pathway at fasttalklabs.com.
Before we continue our conversation on low cadence work, let's hear from Coach Neil Henderson about the effects he sees from this sort of training.
So low cadence work is going to require a greater force from the muscle, and typically you're going to see a little bit of a difference in recruitment at low cadence compared to a normal or high cadence. And so we see some difference in the muscle groups that are recruited at a low cadence. We do get a little bit more glute activation compared to quad at a low cadence compared to what we would see at a high cadence. And you're also going to see some differences in cardiovascular costs. Your respiration rate and total ventilation is going to be lower, as well as your heart rate for the same power when you go at a very low cadence.
To shift gears a little bit, one thing that I think you and Dr. Ronestad said pretty clearly in your review is that low cadence training is not strength training. They're not the same thing, because there is a belief among a lot of athletes that, oh, I don't want to get in the gym and lift weights. If I just go out and ride the bike up a hill at a really low cadence, I'm getting my strength training. And you said, I feel pretty conclusively that no, it's not the same. Is that the case?
Yeah, well, I would say that the study that we published it last year, actually, the study that I touched upon previously, where we did this sprint kind of training, I would say you can call it functional strength training. Of course, it's not heavy weights because it's done on the bike, but we could measure performance improvement in peak power output. And this is something you also measure when you do strength training. We didn't measure strength. So we, of course, we should have done that, right? We should have measured knee extension strength or something like that, leg press or something. But we didn't do that. But we measured peak power output in a sprint, and that was improved by 4%. And this is a result that you would normally see also with strength training.
And so the difference here, right, to outline the two different training modalities, on one side, we're talking about, say, going up a climb at 60 RPM at your FTP.
Right. Yes.
And on the other side, we're talking about doing a short, a 10 second from low cadence, you know, maybe starting at 40 and accelerating at 200, 300% of your FTP. And that's probably going to recruit a heck of a lot more fibers. Right. It's going to really involve your neuromuscular system. Even though they're both kind of low cadence, we're working in two very different manners.
This is a case where when you are starting up from that standing start, I mean, you're taking everything to turn over those cranks.
Yeah. So in that case, in the latter case you outlined with the sprint exercise, you recruit all your fibers, right? When you do submaximal exercise at a low cadence, you also recruit more type 2 fibers. Type 2 fibers, which are the fast ones, but you recruit more of these, or you use them more when you do submaximal exercise at a low cadence. So it's kind of counterintuitive for many people because it's slow, so why the fast twitch fibers? But yeah, it's because of a force. So you have to apply more force in the pedals at the low cadence, and therefore you recruit more type 2 fibers. But not to the extent that what is going on when you do the maximal effort sprints.
And that's why research, you know, Dr. Hansen, you pointed out that there's not necessarily research on, say, this prolonged FTP climbing, you know, but we could hypothesize that an extended period of time recruiting more type 2 fibers could lead to a greater type 2 fatigue and maybe involvement of additional fibers, and maybe there's a training effect there. And it's unfortunate that studies like that just haven't been done, because I don't know that we can definitively give an answer.
So here's an interesting way that they show that, and forgive me, I can't remember the study, but I'll put this in the show notes. There was a study of low cadence training, and they showed one of the differences between low cadence training and high cadence training was you saw a greater depletion of glycogen in the type 2 fibers. So that's an indicator that you are recruiting them more.
Makes sense, yeah.
You're probably talking about Alquist and co-workers from 1992. And that was a really good study showing exactly what you're saying and also what I was talking about before.
Trevor, I told you he was going to be a great guest.
You know all your, you know all your studies. So last thing I want to ask about low cadence. I mean, I think we've said that there's a lot more research that needs to be done. But we just touched on this. What are some of the other theories? If there is a benefit of low cadence training, what is the theories of the physiology behind it? So we just brought up more fast twitch muscle recruitment. Are there other potential ways in which this is benefiting us?
Well, that is an important thing because, again, I hear that you are saying that many of the athletes, the cyclists that you know are doing a lot of cadence work. Well, I know a lot of cyclists here in Denmark who are not doing a lot of cadence work.
Rob was so happy hearing that.
And also cyclists at a very, very high level. We are relatively good these days in Danish road cycling.
I know, I was going to point that out.
And, you know, many of these cyclists, they are just doing many, many hours on the bike. Of course, they are also doing intervals. These days are over where you only do the hours. They are doing intervals, of course, but they are doing many, many hours just sitting there and just not thinking about what they are doing, which means using their freely chosen cadence. And, you know, many of these cyclists, okay, they are good, but I think they could be better. And one way to improve as a cyclist for a lot of them, of course, some are overtrained and they shouldn't do more intensity, and you can find these examples. But for many, many of these cyclists, it's about doing intensity. And a part of intensity is, I think, also doing cadence work. So if you do low cadence, You have more recruitment of type 2 fibers, which you could also term as kind of an intensity effort. If you do high cadence, you put more pressure on the energy systems, on your oxygen uptake and your heart and blood flow. So again, back to what I touched upon in the beginning, since cycling is so many hours just sitting there, a way to improvement is to do variation. And cadence work is variation. And I believe in that. I think it's very important to consider. Also for the mental part, because, you know, inspiration, do something that you didn't do before and you find out maybe you like it. Or maybe it stimulates something that you are not particularly good at. You only find out if you try out new things, but we don't have a lot of research to back it up.
As a professional cyclist, Alex Howes does both low and high cadence work. He gives his reasons and cites many of the same benefits that Dr. Hansen just talked about.
I like to trend probably slightly higher than what people would call, you know, the, you know, quote unquote world average or something like that. I find that, you know, yeah, coming from altitude and racing at sea level and even cardiovascularly speaking, like I'm pretty fit, but in general, I don't have the same sort of strength adaptation that you would have from training and racing at sea level. So I find that a higher cadence sort of shifts the burden from the muscles to the cardiovascular system a bit. And that's not something that I just find. I mean, that's real science. There's science there. So I tend to spin a little bit more when I'm at sea level. That said, it is a bit of the inverse at altitude. Like the higher you go, you know, like the more smashing the gears a little bit more makes a bit of sense just to sort of do the opposite and spare the cardiovascular system a little bit of that burden and shift more of it to the muscles.
That kind of leads me to my second part of the question, which is, do you do any low cadence or high cadence training? Is that something that you focus on?
Yeah, I do quite a bit of both, actually. For racing at sea level, I'll do a fair bit of, you know, high torque, high resistance efforts, just because I know that the, you know, the strain on the muscular system is quite a bit higher down at sea level versus altitude. And then high cadence, I think, is something that people really take for granted. I mean, the sort of the souplesse and sort of art of pedaling has kind of gone out the window in recent years. You know, you have with, I think a lot of it has to do with Zwift and these other sort of on the trainer erg mode, just get on and make the power and then get off. There's a lot of efficiency to be gained in having a good pedal stroke. And I think doing high cadence work is one of the best and one of the easiest ways to sort of help you find that souplesse.
Unfortunately, it looks like Jonas had a little bit of an oopsie in the tour of the Basque Country. So he's going to be spending a lot of time on the trainer coming up. And maybe you need to reach out and give him some suggestions here.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears here and go to high cadence training. And I will say in the research, there seems to be less evidence for the benefits of high cadence training. But something I'm going to point out is there's a big difference between amateurs and pros here. Pros, A, tend to have a much higher freely chosen cadence. And more importantly, in an amateur cyclist, when they go to higher cadences, they become far less efficient. Mm. They're burning a lot more energy. You don't see that with pros. Pros actually seem to be able to maintain their efficiency at higher cadence. Is that just genetics, or is that because they do high cadence training? So what's your feeling on this?
I don't know. Are you referring to some studies for that? Or
yeah, I saw it in a few. So I pulled it out of two places, but I admit it's more coming out of reviews. So I don't know the original studies. But the one that we were just talking about, of the study that did the flat and the uphill time trials led by Dr. Craig Williams, that study raised it. But in particular, I'm looking at a 2021 review led by Dr. Adrian Mader that brought up the fact that you tended to see pros maintain their efficiency at higher cadences. So it says here, it was concluded that the higher efficiency at a higher cadence is one of the main adaptations of professional cyclists.
Well, it's a statement, but I'm not sure I can remember that I have seen the studies that should be behind that statement. And it might be that, you know, I'm just not aware of it. But at least, you know, I know that there's not a lot of studies done, as I said before, on these high performance cyclists. I don't know. But even among the best performing professional cyclists, you still have this relatively large difference in their freely chosen cadence. So you still have some who is doing a time trial, for example, at 90 RPM, and then you have others doing it at 105 or maybe even higher. And you can also find examples of cyclists who are doing it at lower than 90 RPM and performing at approximately the same level. So you also have this difference, but it might be that if you take a group of professional cyclists and compare them to a group of amateur cyclists, it might be that they are a little bit higher in their cadences that they use, and maybe they are also more efficient. But I don't think it's a big difference, actually, if you should compare these groups of athletes. I don't think it's a big difference. I think they're very similar, actually.
That's really interesting. Look, I was just citing some studies. You've been researching this for years, so I'm definitely going to trust your opinion far more than mine, but I find that really fascinating. One thing I will throw out, though, and I believe you raised this in one of your reviews, is the fact that when you are in a race, race is highly variable in pace. You have to be able to respond to attacks. You have to be able to respond to moves. If you're grinding away at 60 RPM and somebody attacks, by the time you get up to speed, they're going to be up the road. So even if it's less efficient, to be able to race, you do need to be able to learn to ride at a higher cadence. So I wonder if that's, pros are willing to sacrifice a little bit of the efficiency so that they can be more responsive and actually effectively race a race. Do you feel there's any truth to that?
No, I totally agree. I think that if you cannot respond, then you're out of the race, you're lag behind. So you need to be able to respond. But that said, if you look at the long stage races, like the three-week stage races, you have a very relatively predictable regime every day. So you go intensively in the beginning of the stage, then there's a breakaway that goes, and then, you know, things settle down until the final. And when once things have settled down and until the final starts, it's often 2 or maybe even 3 hours of cycling where absolutely nothing happens. And you don't need to be able to respond to any attack at all. And my point is where in these 2 to 3 hours, in these particular stages where this is the case, you can actually save a lot of energy if you pedal at a lower cadence. And we know that one of the issues in these long stage races is the accumulated energy turnover day after day after day. So if you can save a little bit every day, you can end up performing better, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks because you have saved energy. And riders are aware of that in the way they live and in the way they relax after stages. And they are very much aware of that they have to save energy and relax. But this is just another place where they could save some energy. It's in these 2 or 3 hours where nothing happens. They could go at a lower cadence and they could actually deplete their muscle fibers less from glycogen and then be more ready the day after.
Let's hear from Coach Shashank Amiri, who agrees we need lower cadence for efficiency, but higher cadence to win.
I feel both of them were super necessary. Low cadence has different purpose of it and high cadence as well. Each of them gives different quality to the riding economy and strength component for the process.
So what do you feel is the benefit of each? What's the benefit of high cadence work?
What I find, even with athletes, they are fit. When I give them low cadence, bigger gear combination for 4 hours ride, by end of the ride, all of them say, what a hard ride was this. I had just recently, one of the athletes is a national team track program. He said, my back hurts.
Yep.
So the benefit from Lois with number one is really focus on your pedaling efficiency. It works on your strength and it helps, especially trying to keep the training within zone two, right? And then when it comes to high cadence rides, one of the things I do on most of the group rides are when we are riding every 15 minutes to 20 minutes, everyone had to accelerate, we call it spin out, for 30 seconds. Basically, this 30 seconds spin out is full on with lightest gear possible and works on your neuromuscular adaptation. And also, as a cyclist, everyone has to know how to sprint. And if you cannot spin your legs, doesn't matter how much strength you have on your legs, you're not going to win or do anything on sprinting. And the benefits really depending on what we are looking for. There are lots of benefits from both of them. And usually, as probably you know, Trevor, that I train all my junior athletes somewhere between 110 to 120 RPM. They have to be able to function with that cadence. Just knowing there's a gear restriction, they cannot put on 55, 11. They are stuck with 52, 15. And if they cannot spin that in 120 plus, they're not going to go anywhere as a junior.
So are pros doing this or are they?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think they do that either.
No, but this is where our study from 2006 that we talked about before, it was very surprising that these athletes were feeling less exhausted after 2.5 hour at their low energetically optimal cadence. So this study and the follow-up study by Stebbins, these studies are just waiting to be applied in the peloton. But when I suggest something like this, the response that I almost always get is that no, you should be able to respond. If you apply a high cadence during this stage, you will perform better in the final because your legs are ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it makes your legs ready if you pedal at a high cadence during this stage. This is the response I get always. I can only say, okay, possibly, but we have done a study that shows the opposite. So it's very conservative sport, and this is touching upon a history. It's also touching upon the finesse, or, you know, you look at a rider cycling, and you see that some cyclists, they are looking good. They are sitting good on the bike. They are pedaling at a cadence that you think looks... Can you follow me?
Yep, yep.
And it touches upon something, the nerve, some of the nerves, you know, in cycling, when you suggest that you should pedal at a much lower cadence. Even that it's only for a part of the race, people are very, very sensitive to it. Unfortunately, I think.
So Dr. Hansen, I actually, you asked me for some studies that were showing this, and I did find one that was an interesting study. This was led by Dr. Andrew Chapman, called The Patterns of Leg Muscle Recruitment Vary Between Novice and Highly Trained Cyclists from 2006. And this is where they put novice and professional cyclists on trainers and had them ride at different cadences and were measuring their EMG activity. And they saw two differences between the pros and the amateurs. One was, as cadence got higher, you saw a very large increase in EMG activity in the amateurs that you didn't see in the pros. The other thing they saw was much greater coactivation in novice cyclists. For our listeners, that's when you have muscles that shouldn't be firing at the same time, firing at the same time, and actually reducing your power, impacting your ability to pedal efficiently and effectively. So that would be my question to you. Is some of the high cadence training, is there a neuromuscular effect where it's reducing coactivation, teaching you to do better muscle firing patterns?
Yes, I believe that. And so it's a training of technique. If you dismount the chain of your bicycle and just try to pedal the crank as fast as possible, there would be a maximum, right? So you will reach a maximum where you cannot coordinate the pedaling anymore. So if we consider that you train that fast pedaling, then of course you would be better at that. So that's neuromuscular coordination training. But whether you need to be able to do that in a race, I don't know. But again, I would not be afraid of doing that. I would actually welcome it again, if not for other reasons, then just for the variation in your training. So it's not harmful at all. It will introduce some variation in your training that you would perhaps find stimulating, or maybe find that the 4 hours that you have to do is less boring than it was if you didn't do it. But we don't have much research data to support that there's a big performance enhancement in that kind of fast pedaling training. I don't think so.
It may just be belief, but let's hear again from Neil Henderson, who feels there is a neuromuscular component to high cadence work.
So cadence and specifically high cadence requires a little bit of a different activation from a neuromuscular side of things. There's going to be a higher frequency of contraction going on. So neuromuscular coordination becomes more important in terms of firing the correct muscles at the right time. A lot of times you'll get co-contraction, meaning that you'll become less efficient actually at high cadence until you train and develop those neural pathways to be able to pedal more and more quickly. This is something that can be improved, but it does take some time and effort to do so. There is absolutely a physiologic cost of pedaling at higher cadences. We've actually done some testing where we actually did 0 watts, but at starting at like 60 RPM, going up 20 RPM, but continuing at a 0 watt load and seeing a pretty significant, we got up to, I think, close to 50% VO2 max at 0 watts at over 120, 140 RPM. It's pretty wild, the cost. We also did a little something with presenter Cy Richardson from GCN a couple years ago, going from 60 RPM to 120 RPM and showing him the oxygen cost effects and also the increase in carbohydrate utilization, even at the same power at that higher cadence because of the shorter time of contraction. So greater reliance on fast twitch muscle fibers compared to a slow twitch muscle fiber.
So I would love to know, it seems like so far we've talked about with training, there are times that low cadence might be beneficial. With training, high cadence may or may not be beneficial. But with performance, a lower cadence certainly seems beneficial in a lot of situations. I would love to know kind of what's optimal, right? Because I'm already thinking like, okay, on my next bike ride, I need to go out and I need to lower my cadence when I'm doing base work. And, you know, as you were just speaking, I was looking through some workout files, like, what do I even ride at? You know, and I'm oftentimes at base, I'm like in the mid 80s and around threshold, I'm in the low 90s. And when I'm closer to VO2, I'm at like 100. So I'm like, oh man, do I need to go out and ride it at 75 today? Like when we talk about optimal, how do we determine optimal for somebody?
Yeah, well, when we do it in the lab and we measure oxygen uptake. So what we see is that if we at the same intensity, at the same power output, do cadences from 40 to 110, for example, you get a U-shaped relationship. So you have a minimum oxygen uptake and it's individual. So you have a minimum and then you have, yeah, a U-shaped relationship, right? So you have higher values at the very low cadence and at the very high cadence, and then you have an optimum in the bottom of the U. It's individual. So the minimum can be at 60 for one person, and it can be at 80 for another person. Or you could get the idea that, okay, it's not easy to measure oxygen uptake, and especially not on the road. So I could look at my heart rate. But unfortunately, you don't get as clear a U-shape if you look at the heart rate. So you actually need to measure oxygen uptake to be able to establish or find out what is the energetically optimal cadence. You need to measure oxygen uptake. So you can have that done in a test lab. And this is what we have done many, many times in our research.
Fortunately for us, that's the next room over.
Yes.
Yeah.
The more you measure training data, the more important understanding it becomes.
In our advanced performance data analysis pathway, we move beyond the basics to explore more complex data analysis. We help you navigate complex techniques so you don't get lost in the numbers.
This pathway features Tim Cusick, Dirk Friel, Armando Mastracci, Coach Dean Golich, Joe Dombrowski, Trevor Connor, Dr. Stephen Chung, and me, Ryan Kohler. We also explore advanced features of WKO, Training Peaks, Exert, and Intervals.ICU.
We use the term deep dive a lot around here, but this is our deepest dive yet into performance data analysis. Follow our advanced performance data analysis pathway at fasttalklabs.com.
So if you were a coach and working with aspiring cyclists, would you give them cadence work? And what sort of cadence work would you give them?
Yeah, I would do that. When you ask that, I'm just thinking about, you know, what happens in, at least in Denmark. So when kids start cycling in Denmark, at least it was like that before, I'm not sure now, but at least before, it was single speed bicycles, which means that they could go fast, but it required also that they move their legs very fast. And they did that for a number of years until they were allowed to mount gears on their bicycles. And, you know, that has been the training regime for many, many of famous Danish cyclists that we have had throughout the history, that they have spent years as kids cycling at a very high cadence. So they have done it because we were forced to do it. But this is not a scientific experiment, right? That's just an anecdote. It's just how it was. But yeah, I would recommend it. But I think what I believe in mostly, if you are talking about what kind of cadence-focused exercise is beneficial, effective, then I would point at something similar to what we did, the intensive sprint cycling. So it's you could consider it as a functional strength training. It's also because we know that strength training is really effective in terms of performance enhancement. So I would go that way rather than thinking that what we do at sub-maximal intensity is important. I don't think it's so important. I think intensity is important. And in that kind of training, you could also focus on the cadence.
I'll admit, after I read your study about that sort of sprint work, Rob and I have always had this debate about whether you do high intensity very early in the season, like in December and January. And after I read your study, that's one of the things I give my athletes, where if I have them on the trainer, it's basically put in their biggest gear, come almost to a stop, and then just try to sprint in that enormously difficult gear. And it just takes everything to turn over the cranks.
And there certainly are studies, I don't remember them off the top of my head, that have shown improvement in performance when kind of sprints are included into base work like that. So yeah, I think that we can certainly say that that's helpful.
And one thing you should consider when if you're doing something like that is the duration of the sprints. So I would not recommend, so if the focus is on fiber type recruitment and strength and peak power, the duration of the sprint should not be very long. So you should not build up a lot of lactate. So it's not that kind of lactate tolerance training we are talking about. So it's shorter, it's below 10 seconds, right, for each effort. So you don't really even, you know, get to feel the lactate burning, because then it's another kind of training. That can also be good, but it's another kind of training than what I'm talking about here.
Guys, I think that we've covered a lot of really amazing information today. And one thing that we touched on is the U shape of sort of optimal oxygen consumption, where, you know, at the optimal, you're at the bottom of the U, and as you pedal too fast, your oxygen consumption for the same workload increases. But that also implies that as you pedal slower, your oxygen consumption also increases. And, you know, we've given kind of that recommendation of slower cadence is probably better energetically, but obviously there is a point where slow is too slow. And
no
that,
such a thing.
No way. There's 35
RPM, you're getting to my happy place. No. I love going up a climb in a 5312.
What happens? Tell Trevor what's happening to him when he's riding at 35 RPM that makes it less efficient and why he shouldn't do it. Tell him he's wrong.
What's happening to me is I'm just in a joyous mood.
Well, I think that compared to the freely chosen cadence, which is the most comfortable for people, of course, then if you go below that, let's say it's 70 for one subject. This is a very average and common freely chosen cadence at a sub-maximal intensity. Then you have, if you go to 60, if you go to 50, then you start feeling it really, really awkward. And I think you would have to go to maybe even 40 before the energy turnover starts to rise again and be so, So I wouldn't be concerned about that, what you're talking about, because for most people, I think they would have to go so low that they would stop before they went so low before the energy. But we can do this, of course, we do these things in the lab in our experiments, and then we can ask people to do whatever. And we can ask them to do 30 RPM or 35 or something like that, and we can get our measurements. But in practice, if you ask people to go low, then most people, they would not go so low that energy turnover, that you would be on the upgoing leg of the U again there, and energy turnover would start to increase again, I think.
I mean, he did say 40, Trevor, and you did say 35.
One thing I will tell you, one effect. I did this on a climb with one of my training buddies.
Were you using power cranks? I need to know that first.
No, I was not using power cranks to make you happy. But I was turning over ridiculously low cadence, and he's sitting on my wheel going up this climb. And his comment at the top was, "That was the best draft ever. You did not vary your pace
you
at all."
Yeah.
So that's the one effect.
I love it.
Well, Dr. Hansen, we didn't even cover half of what I wanted to cover with you. So maybe this is a hope that we can get you back on the show. Like, I was fascinated by your whole description of crank inertial load, which was fascinating to me, and I hope to have that conversation another time. But unfortunately, I think we need to wrap this up. So since you're new to the show, the way we finish every episode is with what we call our 1 minute take homes, which is we each have 1 minute. And as you can see here, we have a timer. It's a 5 minute timer, so it's no use whatsoever.
I've always wondered why we've got a 5 minute timer.
But you have 1 minute to say what you think is the most important thing for our audience to take from this episode. So take a couple seconds to think about it, and then we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, I have at least 2 points. I think variation in training is very, very important to be able to maintain the training, to be able to find it joyful and keep the motivation. And cadence work is a brilliant way, I think, to introduce variation in your training. So that is one reason for doing that, even that we perhaps need more research results to support that there's a performance improvement from it. But that was one point. And another point is that I hope that more athletes and coaches were more open-minded to trying out some new things. I think it's very similar to when the aero bar was introduced by Greg LeMond in the Tour many years ago, where it had existed in triathlon for many, many years. It took too many years until the focus came on aerodynamics in cycling. And that's another example of how conservative the sport is. So I think that even that a lot of things have happened training-wise in elite cycling, I think there's still room for improvement. And this could be an issue here, or this could be a field of focusing on the cadence work.
Fantastic. Rob, you want to go next?
I feel as though I've been vindicated in this episode. I'm choosing to believe that I was right. I don't know. No, I will say it's a fascinating conversation. I do think that there is room, especially Dr. Hansen, as you were pointing out, for just making sure that there's variation in your training. And I know that I'm somebody who I can sit on the trainer, pound out some base miles, get really locked into one specific cadence, and that using something like a cadence variation is actually a way to get some variation into your legs, and that that's probably good for a stimulus. And I am currently, and Trevor, I'll show it to you, I am updating some base workouts with some sprints and training peaks nice. Right now. So I think we can incorporate some of this, but definitely a lot of learning from me. So thank you.
Well, so my take home is pros do a ton of cadence work. I'm a coach that works a ton of cadence work in with my athletes. But, you know, the science isn't that strong here. So, you know, there's things that we look back on that athletes were doing 40 years ago. And we say, can you believe they were doing that? And I worry a little bit that this is a thing in 30, 40 years from now, we're going to look back on and go, can you believe they were doing that? So maybe sort of vindicating you here, Rob, but you know, I still believe in it. I still think there's a value to it. And my assessment based on the little research I've read, and Dr. Hansen, you've read a lot more than me, and the research, the evidence isn't strong. So this is more a gut than me be able to say there's definitive research behind this. My feeling is the low cadence work does seem to produce some physiological gains, but I think you need to do the high cadence work because you have to be able to ride at a high cadence in those key moments in a race. And if you don't train that, the co-activation is going to be high, the EMG activity is going to be high, and it's going to fatigue you a lot quicker. So you need to prepare your legs to be able to handle that.
I think the other side of this too, and Dr. Hansen, correct me if I'm wrong, I have not seen anything that shows cadence work, either high or low, is detrimental to performance, right? So choosing to do this, even if it's just because you like it, it's not going to make you worse. And maybe that's a great reason for it to make you better.
Which is probably where I'm at, because going up a climb at 35, 40 RPM is just joy for me.
Dude, you just have a passion for weird floggings of yourself.
Well, Dr. Hansen, real joy having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, and I joined it very much too.
That was another episode of Fast Talk. The thoughts and opinions expressed in Fast Talk are those of the individual. Subscribe to Fast Talk wherever you prefer to find your favorite podcast. Be sure to leave us a rating and a review. As always, we love your feedback. Tweet us at Fast Talk Labs. Join the conversation on our forums, forums.fasttalklabs.com, or learn from our experts at fasttalklabs.com. For Dr. Ernst Hansen, Alex Howes, Brent Bookwalter, Dr. Bent Ronstadt, Hushang Amiri, Neil Henderson, and Rob Pickles, I'm Trevor Connor. Thanks for listening.